Good morning, welcome to our meeting. It's 11 o'clock, January 23rd, 2024. Intend to convene a regular meeting with Snohomish County PD Board of Commissioners. I'm Sid Logan, President of the Commission. To my right is Commissioner Tony Olson, our Vice President. To my left is Commissioner Rebecca Wolf, our Secretary. Joining us at the table near me is John Harlow, CEO General Manager. Paul Willenrock, General Counsel. Joining virtually is Melissa Collins, Commission and Executive Services Director. The table to my left is Allison Morrison, Clerk of the Board. And we have Jenny Rich, Deputy Clerk of the Board, in the far back right. And Morgan Stolzner, Deputy Clerk of the Board, with the two screens in front of me. The written record will indicate others who are present. Please mute or turn off your cell phones or other electronic devices. This session is for the Board and CEO General Manager to discuss, study and discuss issues among ourselves and the PD staff. Commissioners, are there any items to be added or changes to be made to the public agenda?
We have one at places added. We'll add item 1B at places.
Here's your microphone.
Oh, thank you. We'll add item 1B at places, 2024 power market, cash reserves, and budget updates.
So our first agenda item 1, our CEO General Manager report and study session. Good morning, John.
Hey, good morning, Commissioners. First up is Ryan Collins with our legislative update. Good morning, Ryan.
Good morning.
Good morning, Commissioners.
Good morning.
For the record, this is Ryan Collins, the district's State Government Relations and External Affairs Specialist 3, and I am here to present on our newly formatted key legislation report covering the first 2 weeks of the 2024 session. The purpose of this presentation is to report on legislation we've identified as key state legislation for the Commission. This presentation is only for the Board's information and does not include any recommendations or needed Commission action. While I've left time at the end of the presentation for any questions the Commission may have, please feel free to jump in at any time. I also believe our contract lobbyist, Marion Dockett, is online to answer questions as well. So today is January 23rd, and it marks the day 16 of the 60-day legislative session. So we're approximately just over a quarter of the way through. As of today, over 3,000 bills have been introduced during the biennium. A little over 2,000 of those bills carried over from last year, while approximately 1,400 are new this session. Government Relations reviewed each of those bills and identified 184 that we will monitor throughout the legislative session. Today, we are going to focus on 7 bills that we have identified as key legislation for Commission engagement. These bills would be most impactful, are on a trajectory for potential passage, and are likely to be discussed in the communities that you serve. This is a dynamic list that will evolve over time as we continue to monitor legislation through the key cutoff dates. While there are 7 bills we will discuss today, you can assume in forthcoming reports, some may drop off and some new legislation will be introduced. As you can see, most of the bills we have identified as key legislation have started to move through their house of origin. 2 of these bills carried over from last year are awaiting floor action, the PSE decarbonization bill, which actually passed the House floor last night, and then the third party navigator bill. There are also 3 bills that are new and have already successfully moved beyond the first cutoff. Those are the greenhouse gas disclosure repeal bill, the transmission workforce bill, and the solar consumer protections bill. Finally, 3 others have received public hearings but are still awaiting executive session. Those are the Community Solar, Climate Commitment Act Linkage, and Failing Water Systems bills. I will note for the Commission that the first key cutoff date is quickly approaching next week, Wednesday, January 31st, which marks the policy cutoff in the House of Origin. In plain language, that is the last day a bill must pass out of the House Policy Committees or Senate Policy Committees in the chamber the bill was first introduced. Bills that don't make it past this cutoff date are considered officially dead. Now, to give you a little bit more of an in-depth look at each of these bills. Before doing that, I did want to just highlight and unveil our new reporting format. As I mentioned in my last presentation, to further improve our reporting to the Commission, Government Relations reviewed questions from Commission over the past several years and created this new format. We believe the format you are now seeing will make these reports easier to read, allow you to better understand where bills are at in the process, as well as allow you to follow updates from report to report more efficiently. So to begin, we're starting off with HB 1955, which repeals the greenhouse gas content disclosure provision within the Clean Energy Transformation Act, also known as CETA. In 2023, as required by CETA, the Washington State Department of Commerce conducted an interim assessment of the law. This is a regular requirement under the statute and assesses the efficacy of its provisions and must be conducted every 4 years. During that assessment, Commerce identified similar requirements under CETA and the Climate Commitment Act, also known as the CCA, regarding the reporting of GHG emissions, greenhouse gas emissions. Commerce concluded that the similar provisions achieve the same compliance and reporting goals, and requiring utilities to report under both was duplicative. HB 1955 would remove the reporting requirements under CETA. If this bill were to pass, Snohomish PUD would still report its greenhouse gas emissions, but only to one agency, the Department of Ecology, under the CCA. The bill is largely non-controversial with public utilities, the environmental community, the Department of Commerce, the Washington Utilities and Transportation Commission, expressing their support in a recent public hearing. Snohomish PUD similarly expressed our support for HB 1955. The bill was voted out of the House Environment and Energy Committee last week and is set to move forward in the process quickly.
Brian, I like this new format.
Great.
If you go back one slide, you've got a list of notable supporters.
Yes.
If in the future, if Wapuda is supporting the ROT, could you put that on this?
Yes, we can absolutely include Wapuda.
They're the ones that hit us up the most about
of course.
These things. Thank you.
I do believe they are in some of these, but yes, I'll make sure to
okay.
We'll just make sure to highlight those going forward. All right. Next is HB 1589 and its Senate companion SB 5562, titled Supporting Washington's Clean Energy Economy and Transitioning to a Clean, Affordable, and Reliable Energy Future. You may recall during the 2023 legislative session last year, the state's largest investor-owned utility, Puget Sound Energy, brought forward proactive legislation that would have outlined a path for them to ease out of the retail natural gas business. Under this, the earlier draft, the bill did not call for discontinuing service to current natural gas customers. However, it did include an almost immediate timeline that would have stopped connecting new customers. The bill had a date of June 30th, 2023, which was still included in the bill that passed last night, just 2 short months after the end of the 2023 session. Ultimately, last year, the legislation did fail to pass. This year, on January 11th, HB 1589 was revived for consideration during the 2024 legislative session. You may recall that the legislation last year underwent several significant amendments. The current version of the bill would only apply to PSE and would create a transition plan for them to manage and exit the existing gas service infrastructure. To balance this transition, the bill would require PSE to meet increased requirements via an integrated resource plan and give the Washington Utilities and Transportation Commission, the UTC, the authority to manage the process through oversight of these planning requirements. Since we submitted a report, there has been some action. The bill did pass the floor yesterday with no amendments offered. So again, the same legislation that was that failed last year is headed to the Senate. Government Relations is keep reviewing the bill to understand how this may impact PUD operations, and will continue to monitor the bill's status. We do anticipate additional amendments coming in the next couple of weeks. Next is HB 2082, which would direct Washington State Department of Commerce to conduct a study on the employment and workforce needs of the electrical transmission industry in Washington. It would also set up a work group comprised of labor and industry representatives alongside the study to provide input and future recommendations for recommended actions. Of note, Representative Mary Fossey, who represents Everett and the surrounding areas, is the lead sponsor of the bill, and IBEW Local 77 has been a lead advocate. As you know, additional electrical transmission projects are critical for the state to meet future climate goals and targets. So measuring what the workforce needs may be to achieve these goals is a prudent step towards better planning and forecasting. As such, the PUD is supporting the bill. The bill received a public hearing on January 17th and was amended and voted out at the Post-Secondary Education and Workforce Committee on January 19th. The bill has now passed the policy committee cutoffs and looks like it's going to be moving forward as well.
Yeah. Is this like a one-time study, or does it occur every so many years?
It is currently a one-time study. So they would report to the legislature by 2025. The working group would stay active going forward. At least my understanding is the workforce would, or the working group would stay active going forward and provide additional recommendations.
And this is just for the trades?
Correct, yes.
Next is HB 2156 and its Senate companion SB 6256, which would improve consumer protections regarding solar installations. The bill would require all solar installers to be licensed electrical contractors and require solar installers to use a standardized contract for all solar installs. Importantly, the bill requires the inclusion of important project details, notices, and disclosures for customers as part of the solar contract install contract. This should help PUD customers avoid many of the problematic sales tactics we've been seeing. The bill is a result of robust stakeholder discussions in advance of the legislative session conducted by the Department of Commerce. The legislation will provide protection for our customers and benefit the PUD by formalizing interconnection approval rules that should decrease the opportunity for miscommunication between the PUD, our customers, and solar installers. This bill received a public hearing on January 16th and was amended and voted out of the committee on January 19th. The amended language, which was sought by the solar installers, was supported by the utility industry and further clarifies and refines several of the solar contract provisions. The bill is largely non-controversial and the PUD signed in support. Next is HB 2253 and its Senate companion SB 6113, which would establish a new community solar program in the state. The legislation is promoted by the Coalition for Community Solar Access and requires the state's investor-owned utilities to participate in this new program and would allow community solar projects to be administered by third-party operators. It would also modify program design by expanding the size of arrays that could be built, require participating utilities to implement a virtual bill credit system, as well as implement thresholds for income-qualified customer participation. While the program is technically voluntary for consumer-owned utilities, any public power entity that plans to build and manage a future community solar project would be bound by the bill's requirements. As drafted, this legislation would alter the cost-benefit analysis the PUD would use when considering any future community solar projects. The bill received a public hearing on January 16th, and we anticipate that this bill will likely undergo several rounds of revisions as it moves forward in the process. We will continue to monitor the legislation and will review any changes that may be offered.
Question. Mm-hmm. So this bill would take away the board's authority to take action on cost benefit that staff has presented to us.
So as the bill is currently drafted, it's voluntary for the PUD to participate or not. If we chose to move forward with a community solar project moving forward, we would then be looped into the requirements of this bill.
Okay, so we could choose. Okay, voluntary, thank you.
So if this passed, would this impact our one we haven't built yet, the South Beverly?
We are discussing with the bill sponsors specifically to make sure that the current projects would be unaffected. As of now, our reading is that it wouldn't impact our current projects, but it would impact future ones.
So it's not clear what the legislature's motivation is. I can understand they want consumer-owned utilities to build community solar projects, but then not requiring all publics to do it is sort of interesting.
It's a very interesting it's a very interesting strategy. I think the goal of the legislation is to expand the ability of not only utilities to build these projects, but third-party operators to not only build but manage them going forward. So that's, I think, the general idea is this would expand the community solar. This would expand community solar projects across the state. And there are obviously boils between IOUs and COUs on how that will play out.
So, should this pass, voluntary. However, if the criteria that they would come up with, does is that supposed to be a cookie cutter? guideline for all utilities. I mean, our analysis could be completely different than Clark or whatever.
That is a good read. So the way the bill is currently structured is that the UTC would be required to design the program to meet these requirements for all investor-owned utilities. So there would be those requirements. COUs, if they decided to adopt the program, again, as the legislation is currently drafted, would have to conform to those requirements, but it does appear that there is some flexibility in how you potentially do that. So,
So COUs don't have to participate, because this one line says, however, COUs are bound by the bill requirements if they pursue their own programs.
Correct. So again, as the bill is drafted, the voluntary nature of the program is you either do community solar or you don't.
Okay, but if you want to, you have to follow this, which is now managed by PC instead of the commission.
Correct. There are provisions in there that the boards of the various COUs would have say in how those programs would work, but by and large, yes.
I have two questions. So providing credits, we would have to provide credits on their utility bills. Don't we do that now or not?
We do.
I believe we do. I want to double check with our experts on managers.
Yeah, okay, the other question is, I noticed that Solar Washington is not among the notable supporters. Do you know if they
I don't want to speak on their behalf. I will have to go back and check. Solar Washington, yes. Yes, I did not see them signed in support, but I can go back.
Okay, so others are bound by this. Should it pass? That's public or not?
Correct.
Sorry to.
Oh, not at all. It's an important bill, and so we want to make sure that we clarify.
We just confirmed to the director when the commission makes a request that the whole board is requesting that to go back.
Yeah, sir. What was their request was to find out if Solar Washington is supporting the other.
I spoke to it earlier. Yeah,
I'm fine with
that. 5 minutes. Thank you.
Yeah, it should be easy to find out.
Yeah, and I earlier requested that we include Wapoota, which I saw we did later. Yes. So, is everyone fine with that?
Yes.
Okay.
Oh yeah, Mary Dock, who is our contract lobbyist, also is tracking this bill and has a lot of experience in the solar space. I do want to open it up and see if she has any clarifications.
Hi, everyone. Thanks so much for having me on. I think Ryan covered it well. I think a lot of these questions and answers are emerging as the legislative session is moving incredibly fast. But we're very much in discussions with our utility colleagues, both public and private, and the bill's sponsors and proponents. And so I think the overall goal is to increase community solar in Washington state. But as you all know, the energy sector is just so complex and there's so many different programs and things that overlay. And so it's just trying to fine tune that so that it preserves, I think, that goal of increasing community solar, but doing it in a way that also minimizes the unintended consequences of impacting projects, for example, that we've already done really good work on that you all have invested in. So I imagine week after week, we'll have some updates for you on this, but by and large, the proponents have been willing to communicate with us and are sitting down and we're trying to work through some of those differences.
And to build on that point, we are planning on seeing several iterations of this.
Is it possible there's an opportunity to just remove consumer-owned utilities from the bill?
It is a topic under discussion.
Yes.
Hearing no further questions, I'll move on to the next, which is HB 2201 and its Senate companion SB 6058, which would amend the Washington statute to allow the Department of Ecology to link Washington's carbon market with California and Quebec's. This is a very technical bill that would modify definitions and policies in the Climate Commitment Act related to compliance and carbon market participation. In essence, the bill is helping the Washington state puzzle piece fit with the California and Quebec puzzle pieces for their carbon markets. The legislation would change how the PUD complies with the CCA, how we conduct our generation planning, how we plan to participate in organized markets outside of Washington. Each bill has received a public hearing in its respective policy committee, the Senate Environment and Energy and Technology Committee on January 12th, as well as the House Environment and Energy on January 15th. Government Relations continues to review this bill and anticipates there will again also be several iterations before the end of session. Of note, Initiative 2117, which would repeal the CCA, received enough signatures to appear on the November ballot. That initiative's official certification will complicate the path forward on this legislation.
Do you know where they are in their signature gathering process? Do you know if they're halfway there or getting there?
So for 2117, they submitted their signatures, and that was validated by the Secretary of State, I believe, last week.
It is headed for
the... Yeah. I did see the actual initiative introduced in the legislature last week, and it is moving forward. Okay. Any other questions? No?
It's just an interesting bill that links us to another country also.
Yes. It's
I mean, why not look at EU states?
Yeah, because Quebec has a lot of hydropower, and I'm wondering about that too. It's a long way away.
Yeah, so
that's not really relevant, is it, to our people who manage the supply demand?
Yeah, so I'll certainly defer to our power supply team. But the reason Quebec and California are the two jurisdictions for linkage, they both have set up carbon markets very similar to how Washington has with their Cap and Invest program. The general goal is to increase market size, which should also lower the cost of allowances going forward and make it a more liquid market, among other benefits. All right. Next is SB 6202, which amends the process for how courts administer failing water systems receivership. Under current statute, it is the responsibility of the county where a water system resides to be the receiver of last resort. This bill would amend that law to require public utility districts to become the receiver of last resort. I wanted to call this bill to your attention since it does impact several of our guiding principles negatively. In this case, the bill would diminish local control by forcing the PUD to assume receivership of failing water systems and potentially increase costs to our water customers. As such, the PUD signed in opposition to the bill on January 18th and communicated our concerns to the bill sponsor.
There's a lot of concerns about this bill.
Yeah.
Yes.
I guess the first thing, not all PUDs do water. So a PUD that has never had a water system could be forced to operate one. I guess the other thing is maybe I'm just sort of thinking of the dark side, commissioners, but you know, when a water district approaches us, we work with them and we figure out what's good for them and our customers potentially take them on. But I can see the situation where a water district could just decide to throw their arms up, and when something fails or whatever, they go into receivership, we're just forced to take it instead of, you know, working with us in a collaborative manner to make that more seamless. So it's really surprising.
Those are many of the same comments we shared with this bill sponsor, exactly that. There's lots of concerns as it relates to this bill. We're continuing to monitor it, and there is a chance that we may see later down the line something that is a little bit more narrow. As it was currently drafted, it's very broad. And again,
narrow doesn't cut it. Excuse me, I was just wondering who the sponsors were.
So it's Senator Short, who represents a district out in Eastern Washington.
Thank you.
No problem. All right. If there are no further questions, we'll move on to our last bill, which is HB 1391, which would direct the Department of Commerce to set up a third-party navigator program to administer outreach and provide education on energy efficiency incentives and rebates available to Washington households. This is another bill carried over from last year and was also on our key legislation report. The bill would benefit PUD customers interested in upgrading their homes with more energy efficient appliances by providing program information and eligibility for available federal, state, and local incentives and rebates. You may recall during our reporting from last year that the PUD was supportive of this bill and engaged with the bill's sponsor, resulting in some several successful amendment changes. The bill was reintroduced at its current status in the Rules Committee and is also waiting for action. And with that, I'll see if there are any other questions the commission may have for me.
No, none. Thank you very much. Interesting. I like the new format too.
Great. Why do you do that? Any questions?
Oh, no, I do like the new format. Very good things, about 80%. I think it was about 20%. We got to look at closely.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Thank you, commissioners.
Thank you, Ryan. Great job. Next up, we want to talk through the power supply events.
Before that, I did have a comment on the federal relations report.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
I just wanted to congratulate Dawn Pressler for her appointment to the Marine Resource.
Oh, yeah.
Excellent.
Sorry.
No worries. We want to talk through the power supply events of the long weekend, as well as the adjustments or recommended potential adjustments to our rate increase. And to start with, Jason Duskowski is going to kick us off. Good morning, Jason.
Yeah, thank you, John. Good morning, commissioners. How are you doing?
Great.
All right. Let's hope it stays that way.
Considering.
Yeah. Well, I just wanted to highlight a few things before hand it over to Ryan and Sarah and others to speak to some of the specifics. And, you know, we had quite the event over the Martin Luther King Day weekend, kind of that Thursday through Tuesday. I think it was, you know, consider it kind of a close call for the system. I think there's things we can learn from a regional perspective and then also as a utility. Kind of speaking regionally, we're still putting all the pieces together. There's a lot of data being analyzed. There's, you know, reports being put out and we're learning from those. I think that's going to kind of continue to happen. And I think at the next PNEP meeting, there should be some really good discussion that's on the agenda there. And I am looking forward to that. So we'll continue to learn and kind of dissect it. A few things to note, though, you know, we here in Snohomish County, we hit a new peak for our system. Ryan, I'll talk to the specifics of that. We hadn't seen, you know, 1,600 megawatts since the early 1990s or since 1990. A few of our neighbors, you know, and peer utilities also hit peaks. So we're seeing kind of that load continue to grow, right? We got population coming in. We have electrification, just the beginning of that, electric vehicles. Also, you know, we're not seeing as much gas heat go in, and those things are driving up the load that we're seeing. Kind of the four main things that supplied the load during the event were hydro, thermal, nuclear, and then imports from other regions. The hydro was a little bit limited because of the water year that we're having, both up in Canada and down here, so we had some constraints there. And then on the imports, there were some key transmission lines out of service kind of between the Northwest and Southern California. We certainly could have seen some additional imports there. I think the big lesson learned here is that the margin between the amount of load that we have, kind of those peak loads and generation, is getting thinner and thinner. And as we get closer to that, you know, the chance for a the lights going out, not just high power prices, is increasing. So I think we really need to think about, you know, as we continue to kind of remove thermal units, whether that's coal, you know, or limiting natural gas, how are we going to keep the lights on and having a good plan for that? I also think about that in relation to the Lower Snake River dams. You know, if we hadn't had some of these resources, or if, you know, future There's more coal planned to be taken off the system. If that wasn't on the system, would we have made it through this event? And then, you know, if not, what additional transmission do we need to build to make sure that we do? I think this kind of illustrated that when we become a bubble, you know, there's only certain resources we can rely on. So if we're going to keep the lights on, we've got to have those connections to other regions to import that power and keep the lights on. So I think that's kind of the thing for the region to think about and analyze. We'll continue to get more data on that and kind of understand that. And like I said, I think there'll be a lot of good discussion at PNA. Yes, Commissioner Wolf.
I know that Puget Sound Energy and other utility companies ask their customers to reduce their loads and to voluntarily cut back. In other words, practice load conservation.
Yes, yep, absolutely.
Have we done that ever to ask our customers to conserve?
Yes.
You know, I mean, not talking about the meter issues, but you know, how the meters can help do that. But
yes, we did.
We do it voluntarily at our house, but I don't know.
Yeah. So yes, absolutely. And we sent out some messaging on that and in this event. And you know, we're gonna kind of talk about doing that more and maybe in a little bit of a stronger sense when we get into these type of events. But
and how was that communicated?
I'd have to
press release.
Press release, okay. I hope that someday we can do that, like through texting or email or something that's individual and direct so that people all get it.
Yes, yep, I completely agree. And I think that's a good learning opportunity there. Okay, any other questions kind of from the regional perspective?
Question?
Yes, yes.
Do we still have the agreements in place with some of the large customers, particularly the industrial and commercial, that should we be facing brownouts or blackouts? If there's some way that they operate on a different schedule? There was some time ago, and maybe.
Yeah, so we have talked about implementing a rate to kind of do that with those customers, an interruptible rate. But we have not implemented that yet. And then I think that's another good opportunity.
It was at one time. I think before you were.
No, I got
it. Sorry about that. I know.
Good opportunity.
There's some opportunity there.
And we got to look at all those things. I mean, as these margins get thinner, you know. Those are the things we're probably going to be relying on. Not that we absolutely want to rely on those things, but we need to look at all those options.
Who all are the owners of the interconnect between us and California? Who's the control? Is there a controlling agency or?
Yeah, I don't know that I know the complete answer to that. I think it's kind of between BPA and then I think the owner on the southern side is LA Department of Water and Power. Yeah, I'm not sure of the exact cause that was taken offline. Kind of that's part of the still gathering.
Right, it's not like maintenance is what I read.
Yeah, and maybe it got taken offline a few days early because of another outage. I've been corresponding with PPC about that, and trying to understand that in more depth.
You said they were beginning repairs on the system.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
and that they would be down for like 3 months.
Yes. Yep. Until April 4th. Yeah. Yeah, I'm like, why are we doing this in the middle of winter?
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. I guess so that they'll be ready for summer when they want to sell the summer.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you can see, got some data back on that. You can see the amount of power that we send down there in the heat wave.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, on average around 6 gigawatts or 6,000 megawatts. And then the amount that we received during this cold event was around 4 gigawatts or 4,000 megawatts.
I guess it's just concerning that the big we, the Northwest, don't necessarily have control of that, which is pretty critical.
Yeah, I think it is kind of a shared ownership there.
Yeah.
Yep, opportunity there. So the other piece, you know, I would say for us as a utility is just how we navigate these things from a kind of a financial perspective. You know, if these margins are getting thinner, if we continue to have, you know, really cold or really hot events, you know, we're likely to see these kind of power prices in markets. So kind of continuing, and we already have started to revise and implement some of these things, but continuing to revise and review kind of our energy risk management strategy and how we manage through these things. So those are the two things.
I'd like to hear that.
Yeah, and with that, I will turn it over to Ryan, and Ryan's going to go into a little more depth on some of the specific numbers and things that we saw here in Snohomish.
Thanks, Jason. Good morning, commissioners. My name is Ryan Kyle. I'm the senior manager of power scheduling. And this is my first time here in front of you, other than an introduction, so.
We'll be gentle.
Be nice. I'm not too worried. So, excuse me, I'm here to talk about the weekend from January 11th through roughly January 16th, Martin Luther King long weekend, where we experienced the cold event. Meant to give you a high level kind of perspective of what we were looking at in power scheduling, how we approached the weekend going into it, what we saw and kind of what happened coming out of it. So leading into the weekend, and I'll start by saying as well that this is meant to be real high level, but there is technical language in here. So at any point, if you have questions, please stop and ask. I know that sometimes this can get a little bit in the weeds on the technical side, and it's something that I've lived for a long time, but I know not everybody else has. So heading into this weekend, we did see the cold coming, and we positioned our hydro resources for to get the maximum generation out of it, even given the low water year we're experiencing. So we were storing water at Spada Lake and running Jackson at a low level with plans to ramp it up to the maximum generation. We ramped Jackson to full output by Thursday evening peak, which is around the 8 o'clock PM timeframe, and it stayed at the full maximum output till roughly today. Actually, we brought it down a little bit lower today. So through the whole weekend, it stayed at maximum output. We made room in the federal system for our slice contract in our lower rivers to make sure that we had enough room to flow water through the system, as well as accept water from the mid-sea projects that are kind of in between our projects. But we were managing a lower river constraint at the Bonneville Dam for fish operations. So we couldn't back off maybe as far as we wanted to. We were also managing a Grand Coulee elevation target for the month, where we're trying to store water for the rest of the winter as well as into summer. So we have kind of competing objectives there, where we wanted to use a lot of water, but we also have to remember to save it for the future. We were also working on an accelerated day-ahead trading and scheduling timeframe. So Wednesday morning, we traded for Thursday and Friday. Thursday, we traded for Saturday and Sunday, and Friday, Monday, and Tuesday. Normally, on Wednesday, we would have traded for only Thursday. Thursday, we would have seen Friday and Saturday, and on Sunday, Sunday and Monday. So we have a couple days off there. So we experienced a drastic difference between the forecasted load that we planned on in the day-ahead time frame to what we actually saw in the real-time time frame. So from Friday through Monday, our light load hours, which are approximately 10 p.m. at night till 6 o'clock in the morning, so essentially when everybody is sleeping, we saw loads 98 megawatts higher on average per hour than we had planned. And we saw on the heavy load hours, which is approximately 7 in the morning till 10 o'clock at night, we saw loads 94 megawatts higher on an hour on average. Overall, from Friday through Monday, we were 9,160 megawatt hours, higher combined for that period, and over 11,000 megawatt hours higher for Thursday through Tuesday. And that is against our planning that we did the week prior, not from a long-term planning perspective. The daily high temperature for that time period, Friday through Monday, was 4 degrees colder than forecasted, and 3.5 degrees on the high temperature, and 3.5 degrees lower on the low temperature. I'll have some information on the exact numbers there, but the temperature was drastically different from what we planned to what actually showed up. The total load each day, for Friday through Tuesday, was over 30,000 megawatt hours per day. And to give context, the average January load is around 24,000 megawatt hours. So you can see it's almost 30% higher there. On Saturday, which was our peak load day, the total megawatt hours for the day was over 35,000. And we, as Jason said earlier, we did hit our hourly high that day of 1,603 megawatts. And that was in hour ending 11, which is the 10 o'clock in the morning to 11 o'clock in the morning hour. Typically in January, we see our highest loads in the evening, and the average is around 1,150. You can see that's 450 megawatts higher. So on Saturday, January 13th, that was our highest load day, as I said, and our coolest day that we saw. On the light load hours, again, we were 71 megawatts higher than forecasted and planned to, and 113 megawatts higher than we planned to on the Thursday before. That's approximately 450 megawatts higher on average than we see in a January day. So in the graph below, you can see the lower green line that represents an average January day. The kind of darker green line in the middle that represents what we planned to on Thursday. And the red line is what we actually saw. The scale is a little bit off, so you can't really tell the difference, but you can't see the actual to the average is quite drastic there.
So what had we planned for average? I mean, when we done our went through our budgeting process and
right.
revenue forecast, what line had we used?
So when we planned in the long-term time frame, we use an average. So coming into the month, that was 969 megawatts on average across all hours, which broken out into the off-peak and on-peak or light load and heavy load hours represents roughly that green line or the lower green line there.
And then I know we generate our forecast based on temperatures. We have a correlation between temperature and if we take that model that we use and run the actual temperatures through, do we know, would it have predicted these?
That's a good question. Something we'd have to go back and take a look at. I don't know if we have that ability through the service we use, but that is something we should go back and take a look at.
Just trying to understand, is part of this our own model?
Yeah.
Maybe I can just say something real quick just to answer that.
Peter Downer, Senior Manager of Rates Economics Energy Risk Management. So we have a couple of different load forecasting models. One is our own. The other is some services that we use in the sort of 14-day period. I don't want to take us too far off track, but we will be looking at kind of what our model would have predicted with those sort of weather inputs. But it's usually on a sort of monthly basis when we look at the 14-day forecast. That's on a much more granular basis, and that's really what's used for this sort of shorter term planning here.
Thanks, Peter. And something else to keep in mind why I'm talking about temperatures as well is that, like Peter said, we do have some services that we contract out for that use forecasted weather to help derive a load forecast. And the weather does play a big difference. The temperatures that you're seeing and then versus what comes in does drive the load pretty dramatically. So that's why the emphasis here on the next two bullet points, that the high temperature and low temperature on that day were 6 and 4 degrees lower than forecasted. So we had forecasted a 27 degree high and a 16 degree low, and we saw 21 degrees for a high and 12 degrees for a low. So pretty substantial difference there. So from a prices and cost perspective, for the period of Thursday through Tuesday, the day ahead trading, which was what we did Wednesday, Thursday, Friday for that weekend, we saw on average $858 a megawatt and $609 a megawatt for the heavy load and light load respectively. To give you a little bit of context going into the month, so at the end of December for the January time period, the prices were $85 and $72.50 for those same respective times. So roughly a tenfold increase from what we saw heading into the month versus what we saw in that weekend. We purchased over 44,000 megawatt hours for Thursday through Tuesday, over 25,000 of that on the day ahead, and then almost 19,000 of that in the real-time timeframe. The total cost is just over $34 million for that time period, split between day ahead and real-time, 19.7 and 14.5. Those are preliminary numbers. I should say they're not official as far as what will be billed, but it will be somewhere in that ballpark.
Who is selling power at this time?
It was a kind of a hodgepodge. So pretty much we were trying to get it from anybody we can.
Sure.
We bought some from that was imported out from California. There was some from some gas plants in the region. I'd have to go back and look to find exactly who it was.
Curious in general.
Thanks. And maybe one thing I'll just add is, you know, a number of our peers and other utilities in the region declared energy emergency alerts, basically meaning like, hey, we'll purchase power from anybody at any price. And I think our power schedulers, they weren't seeing any offers out there in the market. So at these prices with no offers, that's an indication that there's no more generation to be had.
Right.
And we're kind of at that, you know, limit of being online or offline.
Yeah, thank you. So alluded to here in this slide, some other items this of note here. So on Saturday, we saw the regional gas storage facility, Jackson Prairie, which is located in the Centralia area, go offline. That causes gas pressure issues in the line for gas plants. So they would have to reduce their power or go offline completely. And we were impacted by that directly as we had a 50 megawatt purchase that was coming from the Grays Harbor gas plant that we had to reduce to zero for our evening peak on Saturday. So between 5 o'clock and 10 o'clock at night, that 50 megawatts we were unable to receive because of this gas plant or gas facility issue. Multiple utilities, as Jason said, declared emergency alerts. So they were essentially willing to buy power, any power at any price from anybody. And as Jason said, on the in the real-time time frame, there was nobody offering power, and there were plenty of people looking for power. Wind resources in for Snohomish from Sunday through Tuesday gave us a total of 85 megawatts. That's over a three-day period. So essentially, there was no wind generation for Snohomish from Sunday through Tuesday. And essentially, that's a microcosm of what the region sees. So very limited to no wind as well in the region for that time period. As we talked earlier, the Pacific DC intertie line, which is what goes from LA to the Northwest, was taken offline from south to north. It's approximately 1 gigawatt or 1,000 megawatts per hour of transport capacity that we were unable to receive. And that was a planned outage. And as we said, we don't know why, but so that was taken offline. So that reduced the ability to bring more power into the region. And then throughout the entire weekend, prices remained near the soft cap of $1,000 a megawatt, both from a day ahead, but also in the real-time perspective. So from roughly Friday evening through Tuesday evening, power prices were around $1,000 any given hour of any given day.
Excuse me, when we talk about gas, natural gas, how does diesel play into that? We use some diesel for certain things, don't we?
I don't believe we have any diesel
power
in our portfolio, but typically a gas plant will have diesel as a backup. So if they loop, and that's typically for smaller peaking gas facilities. Where we had bought power that we were curtailed on, that was coming from a larger facility that can't usually use diesel to generate from.
Do we have any idea how Montana wind did during this? I don't own any, but I know it tends to do better.
I don't know specifics. I do know anecdotally someone from another utility told me that they had a Montana facility that froze up and lost generation almost instantaneously.
Interesting.
And that's, you know, due to the bitter cold that was over there.
They're pretty sparsely populated too.
Yes.
So that would, I think, have an effect on it.
Yeah, I just, when the wind blows, I understand that basin is a little more favorable.
Right, they are typically at a high level more favorable for generating in colder, colder events, but overall, I don't know how. And then, so finally, I wanted to just give some thanks to some of the people that were working over that weekend, specifically the generation team at Jackson, who had a little trouble bringing the facility up on Thursday, but managed to get through those problems and keep it running without any problems through the whole weekend, which was very helpful. Also to our hydro scheduler team and our power schedulers, who worked tirelessly through the weekend, very busy every hour, specifically Ben Beck, Kevin Costello on the hydro desk, and Michael Landau, Sarah Gunsler, and Andrew Cox, who are on the power desk. It was a very busy weekend with a lot of effort put in by the whole team. A lot of people who aren't even on shift checking in, seeing what they could do and how they could help. That's the end that I have for there. Any questions on that? Otherwise, I'll turn it over to Sarah.
Well, thank you. Thanks for all your work you did and your teams did and the Jackson crew. I mean, it sounds like if we didn't have Jackson, we'd be potentially facing brownouts.
It would not have been as good. Yes, I agree.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, commissioners.
Good morning, Commissioner Sarah Bond, Budget and Financial Planning. Just wanted to give you guys a few updates on how this has impacted us financially and some of the steps that we're recommending. So as Ryan mentioned, we're looking at approximately a $40 million negative net impact to our budget in January. We're still waiting for all of the numbers to kind of finalize, but essentially we've lost about $40 million. So you know, we went into 2024 budget with a proposed 3.8% rate increase. That was largely to make up for some of the events of last year. So it's not going to correct this problem. So we've been looking at some options. We've already gone through some substantial prioritization deferrals in 23 and for the 24 budget to kind of help mitigate some of the events that happened last year. So we're not at this time recommending any additional reductions. What we're looking at is recommending adjusting our rate increase to at least 5.8%. And this will help lessen this impact. And it's going to give us some better cushion in the future and in the forecast periods. Though saying that, even a 5.8 increase might not be enough to bring back all of our cash reserves to where we need immediately. It might take some time. So we're looking at some additional options that we're looking at behind the scenes, looking at some reserves. And we're planning on coming back next month with some additional recommendations for you. Well, John, if you wanted to add anything to this.
Yeah, you said that very well, Sarah. It's really, again, we anticipate we will have some increase in retail revenue. We need to see where that falls out. Some market revenue from power sales. There's a number of moving pieces and a number of arrows in our quiver to be able to adapt. And we don't want to necessarily overreact and or but a greater impact from a rate perspective on our customers. We have lots of options and we'll be evaluating those options, and as Sarah said, we'll come back in a month and provide more details on what that can look like. And even looking at, you know, we have other reserves, we have the rate stabilization reserve, we have contingency reserves. Those, you know, rate stabilization by name sounds like it would be a fund that we would want to use to help mitigate the short-term impacts. This is really a rate increase to help get us moving quicker into making those adjustments, getting the additional revenue, and then we'll build that into the longer forecast with the options and additional rate increases in the future that we think need to get us back to where we need to be. Questions?
I do have a question. When is the board going to receive the COSA presentation? Doesn't the board typically receive
COSA
before we take action?
Yeah, we're not asking for any action. That COSA presentation was going to be today, and then we pulled that in lieu of the circumstances that we just went through with the power supply, and in order to come back and provide at least this information, we will be back next commission meeting with that closer presentation on that, what those rate adjustments will look like from a financial standpoint.
So we'll do that, and then action would be the following meeting? Now, is that adequate time? I thought this adequate time to implement it, was it going to implement?
Yeah, it's a great, great point. Our target originally was April 1st. It's maybe pushing on that, and so we have given ourselves an additional month of cushion. And if we can't, you know, if we can't get things to line up accordingly, we'll push that rate increase to May 1st. But we think it's absolutely necessary and worthwhile to take a step back, evaluate what the financial impact was from that weekend, and then factor that into what we need to do going forward.
I guess my concern with pushing it off is that it automatically goes up. We push it off a month, and we've got to make up another month's worth of.
Yeah, we're not looking at it that way. I mean, again, we're in this for the longer term. We want to have this rate increase, but the other pieces, I will say, that align with what the longer term impacts and where we need to be, and we don't want to put additional pressure on all the folks that have to do the back end work to try to kind of jam in a rate increase just to hit April 1st. Again, we may, I just don't want to put anybody into a bad spot if we have further discussion or there are things that we embark on that would strain that April 1st date.
Well, we don't know if the scientists are right or wrong, but they're saying 2024 is kind of like that tipping point year. So we have to adjust to the realities that energy is going to be more expensive, almost surely going forward. And it's time for people to start thinking about that reality. I mean, yeah, I know we want to make it as comfortable as possible for everybody, but the truth is we've waited decades too long to make a dent in the acceleration of climate warming. And that's going to affect us. So we need to start thinking about the reality of all of that.
Yes, what I would say is we want to do our
due diligence. On a cheerful note, right?
Yeah, we want to do our due diligence, make sure that we are looking at our costs, looking at our revenues, factoring in all the risks associated with operating the business, and put a rate increase in place that helps us with a good glide path to where we need to be in the future. Again, having lots of other options and levers that we can pull to get us there. And I will say on a bright side, even at the 6-ish or so rate increase, relative to our peers in the region, that is substantially lower. As you've seen in the press, some of the utilities are in that mid-teen or upper-teen range for power costs. I still think the team has done a fantastic job. We've weathered last year in a way that we're still going to do all the things that we need to do from an infrastructure and utility in the future perspective. We just got hit with another arrow this January, and we're going to weather that storm, but do it in a way that we're thinking long term and what's in the best interest of our customers.
I believe the board would agree with me that until it's seen additional information that we're not today locking ourselves in. At 5.8%.
Yep. No, that wasn't.
So I wanted to make sure that was clarified.
Yeah.
And you're right on with your last statement, which means, perhaps going in and taking a fresh look at the criterion planning that we use. Because I've kind of heard over the last few years, we had this, we didn't expect it, we had, so maybe we're too conservative.
Yeah. It's an all hands on deck really review on the energy risk management side, power supply side, taking a lot of the data that we know. I've used the example, we talk about the gray rhino syndrome in safety. I think you have that in plain view here. I mean, it's It's basic math. We have loads going up exponentially from EVs and electrification, and we have really no increasing load following dispatchable resources coming into play. Until the new technologies are commercialized, we've got to manage this gap as best we can. And that's going to have us having a different philosophy, which we will come back at the appropriate time in the future to really help us think about how do we navigate the future in a better way.
So critical.
I guess I would like, if I hope the commissioners, you guys are interested too, I'd like to understand the interplay between the rate stabilization fund and the rates. So for instance, if we kept it to a 5% rate increase, how much money would have to come out of the rate stabilization fund?
Yes.
That kind of thing. And then obviously the big question is, how do we go from here? I'd still like us to consider whether we're purchasing the right product for Bonneville or not, and if we should look at the other product and what that means for us, and what it would take to get there. Probably rate increases to get there, but maybe more security or confidence. It's not, I mean, Mother Nature is throwing us a curve, as you mentioned, and thrown it now a couple times in the past year. And then, you know, I think it was 3 years ago in February where the region was again almost to this place where we're starting, you know,
5 years ago.
Running out of power 5 years ago, where time moves fast.
Remember, like it was yesterday.
Yeah. So, I mean, those are just in my short career here. And so, you know, I had a whole profession of predicting, and I predicted on history. And when the history is not necessarily representative of the future, then you're in the stock market.
And that's not where we want to be.
You know, what are we, you know, so.
No, it's well said. And we do, again, have to take a really holistic view of all sides of this.
Yeah, we can't put this off, I think, any longer. And I do agree with, did I interrupt you?
No, you didn't.
I do agree with your comments about reserves. I know our customers look at those reserve amounts, but $35 million in a five-day period. The rate stabilization fund is inadequate. I'm also interested in that.
Yeah, all that will be in play and will be factored into the best path forward.
Well, I am happy that we're really seriously thinking about more storage. That's got to happen.
Thank you.
Any other thoughts, questions? That's it for the presentation.
Okay, it is now 12:02, and the board will recess into executive session to discuss the legal risk of current practice or proposed action on the terms set forth in the Open Public Meeting Act. Anticipated the executive session will last approximately 45 minutes, concluded at 12:47. The regular meeting will reconvene here in the commission meeting room at 1:30 p.m.